I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. The bear revolution is upon us. So says Jonathan Taplin, a longtime innovator in the entertainment field and adjunct professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Southern California. He sees cities and states rising in power, with California leading the way, while power diminishes at the center. We'll talk to Jonathan about what that means for a massive service reorganization in our country today on Smart City. And then we go even more local with D.C. Councilman Tommy Wells, who is determined to make our nation's capital a more walkable, livable city. We'll return to Smart City right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Jonathan Taplin is adjunct professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Southern California, where his areas of specialization are in international communication management and the field of digital media entertainment. He began his entertainment career in 1969 as tour manager for Bob Dylan and the Band. In 1973, he produced Martin Scorsese's first feature film, Mean Streets, and between 1974 and 1996, Jonathan produced 26 hours of television documentaries and 12 feature films, including The Last Waltz, Until the End of the Earth, Under Fire, and To Die For. Jonathan, California represents what you believe is a profound experiment in federalism. Explain what you mean.
The problem in the last 30 years of making any progress on things like combating global warming or developing stem cell research or many other issues have been that there is a complete lack of political will at the federal level. And so California decided basically to take matters into its own hands. And so it managed to pass its own clean car law that mandated reduced emissions from automobiles. When the federal government refused to fund stem cell research, it passed a $3 billion bond issued to fund stem cell research. When the federal government refused to do anything about people's individual privacy matters that had to do with their consumer data, California passed a law so that, you know, when you wondered why all of a sudden last year many companies had to reveal that they'd lost your credit card numbers or they'd lost your social security number, that was only because California passed a law saying they had to notify you if they did that. So once California starts that, then many states follow the leadership. And so now there are, you know, almost 14 states representing almost a third of the population in the United States, aside from California, that want to follow our fuel standards laws. There's seven states who passed their own laws on stem cell research. And so these things have a knock-on effect, and it allows states to make moves that the federal government is either unwilling to or unable to because of, you know, the close balance of power in the Congress.
What are the tools that you believe will accelerate this devolution of power?
Well, the basic factor of the internet revolution, of the digital revolution, is that it allows cooperation at a distance. And needless to say, you know, we see that every day when we watch Google's stock go to $500. I mean, Google is the essence of a company that is cooperation at a distance. In other words, the millions of people making their votes on the Google search engine allow you to get the best possible results. And these kinds of evolutionary technologies that have come out of the digital revolution are everywhere. I mean, if you think about what's happening in the culture space that I study, whether it's MySpace or Facebook or YouTube or Flickr, this ability for people to cooperate over the backbone of the internet without ever being face-to-face, without maybe even knowing who they're cooperating with, is incredibly powerful. So what we're beginning to see now is new forms of cooperation that involve things like developing malaria vaccines and all these things that are done using the same kind of open source model that was started in the software world, but now is flowering in many, many ways. And that is really the essence of what this is all about. And when you think about it, the ability in California especially and in the Southwest for me to put solar panels on top of my house, and sometimes I'm, you know, creating my own power, and sometimes I'm selling power back into the grid because I have devolved the power out to the edges of the network.
Is California's power a result of its size? Could other states accomplish the same thing?
Well, that's obviously got a lot to do with it. I mean, clearly, when California creates a new energy efficiency law for appliances, then everybody who is a manufacturer of big appliances, washing machines, etc., has to follow that law because they can't neglect a market the size of California that may make up as much as 20% of the, you know, appliance market in the United States, or may make up 22% of the automobile market. So even though the automobile companies and the federal government have been fighting California over its clean car law, ultimately I believe that, you know, California will prevail. And, you know, Justice Brandeis many years ago said it was the genius of the federal system that a bold state could do experiments that the rest of the country could then follow on. And that's, you know, what we're seeing in action here. And so clearly the fact that California is such a large market gives it market power, and that's important. But that's not the only issue, because ultimately smaller states are following along behind us, and, you know, it's this frozen system in Washington which is causing so much frustration and so much cynicism that gives us the opportunity to get away from this. And, you know, the notion of states' rights used to be a kind of right-wing issue, but my point is that it doesn't need to be. That, you know, that when I first started writing about this, I said, quite frankly, I don't want to live in Tom DeLay world. And that's what was being created in Washington. Now things have changed a bit, but still the basic idea that innovation happens in smaller units is something that almost every businessman believes in. You know, if you talk to Jeff Immelt, the chairman of General Electric, one of the biggest corporations in America, he would tell you that he's trying to push power out to the edges of his organization. And that's key. And there's no reason that shouldn't happen in the government as well.
What kind of leadership is needed now that power is being pushed to the edge?
Well, I mean, you know, in the old days, we used to talk about city-states, right? I mean, what was Athens? But it was a city-state. So in the sense that Los Angeles and New York and Atlanta and Dallas are city-states in the sense that they're so big and they have so much power, one could take the power out to the edge, literally to the level of the mayor. One would say that Los Angeles, the mayor goes and does his own foreign policy trips. He went to China last year. So I'm not saying it has to be an Arnold Schwarzenegger. I mean, that we're quite gratified by the moves that Governor Schwarzenegger has been making. I happen to sit on his broadband task force, and he is going to make a really strong effort to make California the world leader in broadband. Now, that's a big jump.
As leadership moves to state and local leaders, what does that mean for America?
I think it's the greatest thing that can happen. I mean, if you think about, for instance, healthcare. Universal healthcare is an issue which has been on the national agenda, you know, since Richard Nixon, and nothing has ever happened. And the Clintons tried it, many people tried it. And now it's actually been passed in Massachusetts. I believe it'll be passed in California. It'll get passed in Vermont. And so what will happen is we will get to universal health care. It just won't be through the vehicle of the federal government.
Some states are doing very well economically, some are not. How do we work through those inequities to pay for those things that you think should be devolved to states and local communities?
Well, my take on this has been is it's not as unequal as you think. If you look at a map of where all the new Japanese and Asian car factories have gone into the United States, they've gone into states like Alabama, Mississippi, Tennessee, places that were traditionally thought of as poor states. And these new, you know, when Toyota moves in a huge factory that employs 15,000 people, it rapidly expands the tax base. Toyota is happy because obviously in Japan, very supportive of a Mississippi state universal health care system. So, I mean, the point is states are going to have to struggle to go to the top. In other words, to educate their students, to have be the places where the new industries want to go into them. And instead of, you know, fighting to see who can be the biggest tax cutter, they may have to rethink those ways of doing things. And quite frankly, industry will follow, as Robert Florida's work has shown, will follow where there's bright people and diverse populations and openness and, you know, universities and places of learning. And, you know, we are in a knowledge economy. And so states are going to have to work hard not to prove that they're cheap and tax cutters, but to actually prove to industry that they're the places where the smart kids are going to come out of schools and be able to go to work.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Jonathan Taplin. He is adjunct professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Southern California. You cite car manufacturers as one example, but I'm thinking of all the recently located car manufacturers and the tax incentives that they have relied upon to states have relied upon to attract these car manufacturers to those states. And I'm trying to think how you pay for health care, universal health care at a local level, while you are providing tax breaks and not receiving tax income, the expected tax income, the tax income you receive from everyone else, from car manufacturers. Yes, it would make them more competitive if they did not have to pay for their workers' health care, but they seem to be taking it out on the front end in taxes.
Yeah, but states can't do this to the extent this kind of race to give away the store would not be possible in the kind of future that I'm envisioning. They will be more dependent on their own, you know, revenue base to fund more things, including education. I mean, my notion is that, you know, inevitably state taxes will rise and federal taxes will fall. So the balance will move more towards the states being able to support more of their economy, not from block grants given them from the feds, but by their own tax base. So that kind of self-destructive, you know, give them a 30-year tax break on something is just not going to be possible anymore. And, you know, Haley Barbour knows that in Mississippi very well, you know. So, I mean, and second place, you know, quite frankly, the Toyota factory of today has a component of the knowledge economy in it. If you look at the number of robots in that factory and the kind of skills that are needed to run that factory. It could be argued that that is part of the knowledge economy.
You've said you expect federal taxes to go down and state taxes to go up. How do you expect responsibilities to shift from the feds to the states and to local communities in that scenario?
Well, my sense is that there is a duplicative bureaucracy that sits in areas like education, housing, and many areas in where you have a gigantic federal bureaucracy in Washington, and you have almost exactly duplicative bureaucracies in every state capital. And that, to me, seems like an absurd waste of money. And my hope is that, you know, we can evolve to a situation where many of these aspects can fall to the states, and that the feds, I mean, the Jefferson model is that the federal government should be thinking about the State Department, the Defense Department, the Treasury, the Veterans Administration, and Social Security, you know, and let the states worry about agriculture, housing, education, and things like that. Because quite honestly, there will be differences. And my hope is that because there will be a kind of competition between the states, you know, we will learn what the best practices are. Because we're not learning it now. The best practices are not coming to the top. The way we're learning best practices in education is through small things like the amount of money that the Gates Foundation is spending on individual charter schools. The ultimate in devolved power.
You say that there are two competing groups jockeying for power across the knowledge gap, the industrialist and the digitalist. Describe them and their outlooks.
Well, the industrialists basically come from a top-down, centralized, hierarchical mindset. And it is the mindset that has worked and ran industry in the United States since the 19th century. Is certainly the mindset of the Pentagon, and it has been a mindset that has been adopted by most of the large bureaucracies in the United States. What happened when you had Gordon Moore in 1965 propound Moore's law was that it flipped the economics and the kind of classic economics on its head, because basically what it said was that the power of the microprocessor would double every 24 months so that you could get a computer that was twice as powerful for the same price every 24 months. And that, he said this in 1965, and it has stayed true for almost 50 years now. So that's an astonishing fact. And what it means is that in the digital economy, in the knowledge economy, everything constantly gets cheaper. It doesn't get more expensive. What's possible in the digitalist mindset is the ability to use these technologies to push things out to the edge always. And the fact that Google went from zero market cap to almost $200 billion, that is one of the largest corporations in the world, in 4 years, is a point of the fact that scaling in a distributed universe is not the problem.
If you were a leader in a traditional sense, how would you be harnessing the bottom-up networked power that the digitalists favor?
Well, you do what Barack Obama is doing. You know, you use the web to harness hundreds of thousands of people. You know, when he raised all that money, it was so shocking to Hillary Clinton, who came from a top-down mentality. They didn't know what hit them. The fact that he was able to outraise her without any of the Terry McAuliffe, the centralized organization of go, you know, get Norman Sue to raise, you know, $800 million or, you know, whatever he raised. I mean, the point was that they were just two opposite ways of approaching things. So as a politician, you basically want to be a listener. You want to be, have a distributed network of contributors. You want to have a distributed network of supporters. And the thing about Obama, and I my guess is it will prove to be true in the next time we see the quarterly raising, was most of his contributors have given him $100, $200, $300. Most of Hillary's contributors are maxed out. They gave the $4,200 the first time, and that's it.
You've called for a redefinition of national security. What should the new definition be?
Well, the key to it is understanding that America's power flows from our culture and our economic power, and not necessarily from our military power. I mean, one of the things that has been a shock to people who are, you know, working in the national security business is that, as someone from the Naval Academy has put, we are in the first war between networks and nations. Let's say that we will have ended up spending $2 trillion in Iraq. What do you think the total cost of the insurgency is? If it's 50 million, I'd be shocked. So this is what is known as asymmetrical warfare. The point that I'm trying to make is that the Berlin Wall fell down because of an idea. And the reason was that those kids were already in MTV Europe. You know, they were already in the American mindset. That's all shot now. That's gone, thanks to a president who thinks that our power flows only out of a gun. And so all of that goodwill, all of that wonderful spirit that everybody loved America is shot. Now, I'm not saying it can't come back, and quite frankly, I think it will come back. But we've lost our mojo, and the point was that the Berlin Wall came down not because Ronald Reagan was had a bigger army than Mikhail Gorbachev. It came down because of the spirit of freedom and liberty that America represented, and people wanted to buy into that. And so the problem now is that if you owe the Chinese a couple of trillion dollars, you owe the Japanese a couple of trillion dollars in terms of the owners of our treasury bills, they aren't your partners, they're your bankers. And that's not a comfortable position to be in. So if we constantly have to go borrow from the rest of the world in order to fight these wars and maintain this, you know, extremely aggressive Pentagon that soaks up 55% of the capital budget of our discretionary funds every year, and nobody else is spending anything close to that, then we're going to be at a disadvantage, and that disadvantage will get even bigger. And Warren Buffett said it best. He said, we're going to turn into a sharecropper society, meaning that we're going to owe the rest of the world so much money that our children will just be working for the man, so to speak. And that's not an outcome I want to see for my children.
At the same time, you've said that America's cultural influence abroad is waning. Best case, what do you expect our influence to be in the future?
Best case is that we will at least be a player alongside many other players in the world in the cultural sense that allows people to experience the best of what we do, and not, doesn't have this kind of anger component. Because, you know, when people are angry in Islamabad, the first thing they do is burn down the Kentucky Fried Chicken, you know. And the question that I see, I mean, first off, it's very clear to me that the Chinese and the Koreans and everybody, I want to tell their own stories now. And so those stories will begin to get distributed around, and our competitive advantage in the entertainment business is probably never going to be what it was. But that doesn't mean that we can't be well thought of and that our cultural output can't be part of the world conversation. You know, if we can get away from this thing of just being an object of anger and hatred to a place where we're just one of the contributors to the cultural conversation, that will be a victory.
Jonathan Taplin is adjunct professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Southern California. After a short break, we'll talk to D.C. Councilman Tommy Wells, who is determined to make his city a more livable, walkable place. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Chamber Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis and the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from Planetizen assistant editor Nate Berg.
With more than 365,000 people, the city of Arlington, Texas is the largest city in America without any public transportation. But those days may be coming to an end, as the Wall Street Journal reports that the Arlington City Council is considering a plan to latch the city onto neighboring Fort Worth's public bus system. Most of Arlington's residents commute to jobs outside the city, and though voters have thrice rejected plans for bus systems over the last three decades, public officials say that today's high gas prices may be enough to get residents behind a bus system. But a strong NIMBY attitude is still present, with residents arguing that the city is too small to need a bus system, and fearing that public transportation will act as a welcoming mat for poor people. But if negotiations work out between Arlington and Fort Worth, residents can expect at least 6 months of bus service on a trial basis, and probably more. And in Atlanta, plans are moving forward on the Beltline, an ambitious 22-mile loop of park space, trails, rail lines, and mixed-use developments that would ring the center of the city. But with the projects is coming a sharp increase in property values around the proposed site. A new study from an affordable housing advocacy group has shown that property values within 1/8 of a mile of the proposed Beltline have seen huge increases since the project was announced. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution reports that the rise in property values has resulted in increases in city and school property taxes, in some places by nearly 70%. The study claims that unless the city sets up tax breaks for the many low-income residents living near the Beltline, the project will cause hyper-gentrification and price many low-income residents out of the area. And across the country in recent years, many cities have been pushing for the creation of municipal networks for wireless internet service, or Wi-Fi. But for many of the biggest cities in the nation, these plans have all but disappeared recently. Cities such as San Francisco, Houston, and Chicago have been forced to abandon their plans for municipal wireless networks due to rising costs and uncertainties about their long-term economic sustainability. But as the Christian Science Monitor recently reported, municipal Wi-Fi is thriving in smaller communities all around the U.S. St. Cloud, Florida, Brookline, Massachusetts, and Owensboro, Kentucky are just a few of the smaller communities that are now wired, thanks to smaller and lesser-known IT firms. So while big cities continue to fumble their Wi-Fi dreams, the small towns have taken the lead in the wireless revolution. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for Planetizen.com. Tommy Wells began his Washington, D.C. career in 1985 as a social worker in the district's Child Protective Services Agency, eventually becoming director of the D.C. Consortium for Child Welfare, an organization of 20 nonprofit agencies that serve the city's children and families. He was elected to the Council of the District of Columbia in 2006. Last week, he staged a car-free day in Washington, D.C. You're planning a car-free day in Washington, D.C. Tell me about it.
Yes, we're holding our very first car-free day for Washington, D.C. on September 18th. And we have the full support, of course, of the City Council and our mayor. And we have a lot of partners in the city where we're really going to celebrate the fact that we have a very livable, walkable city. And so we're asking everyone to go car-free, you know, take the bus, ride a bike, walk to work, discover your neighborhood.
Why did you choose this vehicle, so to speak, one day on which you urge citizens not to drive?
Well, the International Car Free Day is September 22nd, and that's on the weekend. I wanted to be sure that we did it during the week when people really could make choices about how they get to work on that day. And again, I think that at a time when we're all concerned about the environment, we're concerned about healthy living, that especially in a city like D.C., where unlike the suburbs, where everything's kind of categorized of, you know, stores over here, homes over there, schools over there, in D.C., we have, you know, we're a very walkable city. And I really do want to celebrate that and get our citizens out. You don't want to do it when it's too hot in the summer and too cold in the winter. We, you know, want to get folks that had not necessarily been out before, walking to work, walking to restaurants, to get them to try it on.
Now, a couple of questions. You say D.C. is a walkable community, and you're certainly hinting at why, but talk to me specifically about that. Why do you say D.C. is walkable?
Well, we're not 100% there, but in D.C., we pretty much have an elementary school in walking distance to every family in the district. We also have a lot of people that are moving back into the downtown, the core of our city. And if you live in the downtown core, you can walk to restaurants, you can get to drugstores, and we're really pushing to try to bring more grocery in downtown. We do have a number of neighborhoods, again, like Capitol Hill, where you have health care, fresh food, and those things that we want you to be able to walk to. But then we have a lot of places in the city where we're still creating mixed-use development. But all in all, our city, I have to say that our residents do have a higher portion of taking rides by metro or bike or walking. And, we're going to celebrate that, but it's what makes our city special.
Now, you said that you wanted to try this out on a day when the weather was not too hot, not too cold. But, of course, I would presume that your goal is to get people to do a lot more, use alternative transportation much more in their daily lives and not worry about the being hot or being cold, dress accordingly and get out and get out of the car. Do you think that's possible in D.C.?
Well, you know, I really appreciate that question because having a day like this, the point really is to keep the conversation moving forward. We really want to think about when we rebuild our streets or put in any new streets, that we do things like complete streets to really lift up getting more people to ride bicycles, more people to use alternative transportation and mass transportation. And D.C. is also looking at making a substantial investment in new above-ground light rail. As you know, we have one of the best subway systems in the country, but how we connect to our subways is another matter. And so it really is not just, is this the right day? It's really to get the city to engage in the conversation about what are we going to be like going forward and what more things can we do to get people out of their cars, on bicycles, walking, skating, whatever mode of transportation they want to take that doesn't necessarily have to be in cars. And, you know, our city, like many other cities, is beginning to generate people coming back into the city to live. And we have a goal of bringing another 100,000 people to live back in Washington, D.C. And if we do a one-to-one of everyone having to have a car, we're really going to just recreate the problems that we've had in the past.
And as a council member, what are the public policies that you think will encourage walking and other forms of alternative transportation?
Well, one of the things we're doing is that we're creating, I've got legislation to see that all of our government buildings have bike parking, safe, secure bike parking, so that when you do business with the D.C. government, you know that if you ride your bike, there'll be a place, a safe, secure place to leave your bike. So beginning to lead by expectation, but with a law that we're going to do a study of all of our government buildings and see that they have adequate bike parking. But also really looking at street corridors of how to promote walking. We're putting a $611 million investment in a new baseball stadium. I want to see that we take state-of-the-art planning to see that our baseball stadium, you don't have to get there by car or subway. You can also get there by walking because we'll have safe, lit streets that are connected to the metro stations. And then also I'm pushing for bike valet. like they have in a couple of other cities. And then the other thing that we're looking at is really trying to get the city to adopt as a policy, if not by law, that as we build or build out some of our streets, that they be complete streets, that they're streets that look at being able to take either rapid transit buses or light rail, besides just cars, and also a separate lane or corridor for multimodal transportation with bikes and other types of things like scooters and, well, you know, electric scooters or things like that to share the road. We have over $10 billion of new investment going in just along one of our rivers, the Anacostia River. And we essentially are creating a new mini city in Washington, D.C. And I want to be sure that the main street of that city isn't just built for cars.
What does it take, Councilman, to make the additional investment to do what you call complete streets?
Well,
what's the increment?
It does cost more, but it also, I do think that we are putting so much public investment into our city through, we're building along our river where a lot of cities have already done that, but as we build along the river, there was never the infrastructure underneath the ground for sewage and all that, so there's a huge public investment to make that area available. And I'm asking just to add this on into that public investment. And if it costs 10, 20% more of what it would cost otherwise to remake a street, then I'm really looking to get the city to adopt that as a policy and an expectation that as we build our streets for the future generations, that they not just be built around cars. And D.C., like many other cities, almost all of our streets were really lately have, over the past, you know, since the 60s, have been ways to get commuters in quickly and commuters out quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And in D.C., we have over 410,000 people that commute into the district every day that do not live here. And we just have to find ways to manage that differently.
I take the metro all the time in D.C. Never think about taking a bus. I know that's something you've looked at. What's wrong with the bus system in D.C. that I never think about taking the bus?
Well, I think that that's a very interesting question that we have to answer across the country, but also especially in areas that are traditionally south, that buses and other forms of mass transportation are really part of our national culture and how you feel about where you are in the strata of things. That historically, especially in the south, buses were viewed, especially since the past maybe 30, 40 years, have been more for poorer people. So if you ride the bus, that means maybe you can't afford a nice car or something. And I know that just the military folks that work down at the Pentagon, when the buses come down there, they call the bus the loser cruiser. And so there's a perspective of the bus. And so really what we're looking at is a couple of things. One is, how do we make a bus, when's a bus not a bus? And we are adopting something we call, as you've probably seen in D.C., the circulator. And the circulator is European-designed, red, big windows. It has the route painted on the side of the bus so you know where it's going. And we're getting more riders on the circulator who otherwise would not have ridden a traditional bus. We're also bringing in express buses that are very nice that go to towns like Silver Spring and other suburbs where they can ride the express in. But what we need to be careful of is not creating kind of a stratification that, you know, the city buses are known to be dirtier and you know, one group rides them and then another group rides the circulator, another group rides the metro. But that's part of our challenge is translating mass transportation into something that's great for everyone.
This is such a curious question to me because it certainly, as you say, and I'm a Southerner, so I know exactly what you're talking about. The loser cruiser, gosh, I hadn't heard that terminology, but certainly I think that's an accurate, fair depiction of a lot of buses in a lot of cities. And so the solution has been, well, let's create a new bus system. I guess thinking that altering the existing bus system would just be what, too big a marketing leap, too big a just an image leap? Why wasn't that the solution?
Well, You know, it's very interesting that you asked that, because I think back in years ago in Minneapolis, when they decided what they were going to do, now they're much further north, about mass transportation, they put their money into buses. And then Jesse Ventura came along and put in what they said was a light rail to nowhere, which actually wasn't to nowhere, went to their mega mall. And now it's been so successful that they're looking at doing more light rail, which is so expensive, rather than going with the bus. I, you know, in terms of our how we deal with the fact that buses are cheaper, they're a more flexible system that we can deal with, and dealing with communities, we just have to be very strategic. The other thing about the bus, as you know, is that they have these long routes. And what we're trying to backstop the bus with the circulator, is more of a shuttle, or, you know, a circular route where you know that they're coming through. And I think that there's a lot of things that we're learning by creating alternative bus systems that hopefully can be applied to our current bus system. But you're right. It is a challenge. It's a very curious question about when's a bus not a bus, and how do we get people into mass transit so they feel like it's a choice rather than a default?
You were elected to council in 2006 to represent Ward 6. Tell me where Ward 6 is.
Well, Ward 6 includes the nation's capital, or Capitol Hill, as they say. It also borders along the Anacostia River. And Ward 6 has probably more economic development going on beyond just the new baseball stadium, but also along the waterfront, and then an area we call NoMa, Mount Vernon Triangle. Probably has more, well, it certainly has more economic development going on than anywhere else in the city. It's 50% of the whole city's economic development.
Wow.
And it's probably more concentrated than almost anywhere in the eastern seaboard. But along with that, we have more public housing units in Ward 6. We have the majority of the homeless beds in Ward 6. And so we're really a blend in the ward. And it's a very interesting dynamic area. But we also have more painted bike lanes than anywhere else in the city. And we have a lot of civic-minded, kind of green-minded, public-spirited people that live in Ward 6. And it's an incredible opportunity to make the kind of investments and cultural changes that we need for building a community and leading the city for the future.
Is Eastern Market in your district?
Oh, yeah.
In your ward, I'm sorry. What are you doing about Eastern Market? Of course, it burned, and tragically burned. What are you doing to replace it?
I love that you bring up Eastern Market, because Eastern Market is kind of a commons for our community, where all races, young, old, all, you know, income differences gather at Eastern Market on Saturday and Sundays, and sometimes during the week, to buy fresh food, also to buy crafts by local artisans, and it really is a neighborhood bazaar. And what happened, of course, as you know, is that it burned. Now, we didn't lose the whole building, but it will take a while to rebuild it. And one thing that we learned is that this bazaar we have, this commons that bring people out on Saturdays and Sundays, is an economic generator for the whole area.
Mm-hmm.
And we needed to keep it going. So the mayor, Mayor Fenty, and his staff, we worked together, and the mayor moved very quickly to create a temporary structure called a sprung building. Essentially, it's fabric over aluminum ribs or steel ribs, and it's the same footprint of the old Eastern Market. So we could take the merchants, and we've put them into the new market, the temporary structure, exactly where they would have been and where they will be going back to the old structure as we get it rebuilt.
That's great. I love that. I love the market.
Well, and as you know, it's just it really brings the community together. It's kind of our commons.
Clearly. Why did you run?
Well, I ran, you know, it's a dynamic time in our city. I really do believe in, I love Washington, D.C. I came here 25 years ago from Alabama. And when I walked out of Union Station, I just fell in love with the city. My heart started racing, and it's never stopped. And it is, again, a fantastic city, but also it's a great place to live. And there's a lot of interesting people here. We're a diverse community, black, white, Hispanic, and others. And to, you know, I've always been called to public, to public service. My first job here, I was a child protection social worker in this city. And it was an incredible way to get to know every corner of the city. And I just have found that you can do more good through policy instead of, I'm not great as a person changing people's lives one at a time. I really have been far more satisfied working on policies that change lives, kind of more of a broad brush, like you can do in public office.
What are the hurdles to doing that?
Well, I think some of the hurdles are is that whenever you are trying to lead, there's, you know, that can be kind of threatening. As you know, in D.C., like in other areas of the country, we're really struggling with the issues of gentrification. We see it through our transportation choices that you and I just talked about. And so part of the hurdles is as more people move into the district, as land prices go up, are we able to maintain affordable housing? Can we be a diverse community? Additionally, can we continue to be a city where you can retire? Can you age in place in Washington? And those are hurdles. And I really do think that working across cultural lines, racial lines, and other things that divide us can really be a challenge, and it can be threatening. And so when I ran on the platform of wanting to create livable, walkable cities, and that we create livable, walkable neighborhoods. And, you know, you have to really be sure that people don't see that as code for gentrification. And that's part of the challenge for our city right now.
What do you think is a proper response to that? Because I think you're absolutely right when you talk about livable, walkable cities. You're right. It's read as code to a lot of people. I know you have a social service background, and you talked about your ward and how mixed it is. What do you think is the strongest signal you can send to people in terms of your real intent to create a mixed income city, a diverse city for people of all backgrounds?
Well, for me, I think you have to have a core sense of values and operate from that core sense of values. And for me, what that means is that everybody that lives in my ward, and I know this, you know, obviously sounds very political, but everyone in my ward is as important as the next person, whether it be a child, a senior, black, white, rich, poor, and you really have to approach that way. I believe that the way I've created my personal staff who do, you know, in my place when I'm not able to do all my constituent work, I have a very diverse staff, and the reason for the diversity isn't just for symbolic reasons, but it's for cultural competence, so that my office can clearly, culturally, competently reach those that need our assistance anywhere in the ward, no matter who you are.
Well, Councilman Wells, I wish you very good luck with Car Free Day and your efforts to make D.C. a more livable, walkable city. Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Well, thank you so much for your Smart City radio program. It's very important, and your participation in leadership and keeping the dialogue and sharing practices between communities across the country is extremely important. So thank you for doing this.
Councilman Tommy Wells represents Ward 6 in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Do you need to mail a package or pick up some groceries or buy a new iPhone? This week's City Views commentator Walker Smith says, get in line.
I enjoy waiting in line. I'm always hustling from one thing to the next with few chances to reflect or rest, so getting queued up in a line can be a nice break. I can put my mind in neutral or do a little thinking ahead to get a jump on what's to come. Of course, not everybody feels this way about waiting in line. Lots of people won't wait 5 minutes for a table at a restaurant. But I don't mind waiting, even as long as an hour. I just find a place to hang out and watch the crowd. When I was in college, the long, circuitous line to register for the semester ahead was the best place to find out what courses to take and which lecturers to avoid. College students, of course, are the artiste of waiting in line. After all, lines at the cafeteria, at concerts, at sporting events, or even to get one's diploma are an unavoidable fact of college life. Nowadays, I'm an old hand at airport security lines. I stand in them 3 or 4 days a week. I use this time to learn about the electronic gadgets that other people are using or carrying. And I'm a smarter buyer of computers and cell phones as a result. Not all lines are created equal, however. It takes more imagination and patience to make the best of a line of traffic at rush hour than it does to make the best of a long line at the grocery store on a heavy shopping day. But public radio is a good companion stuck in traffic, and the tabloids at the register are good entertainment in the grocery store. In fact, I find tabloids to be particularly informative, not because of what they report, but because of what they reveal about how we think and what we want to hear and believe. For me, this is the best sort of thing about waiting in line, the chance to learn what's on people's minds. For example, in the security lines at the airport, there seems to be a correlation between the patience people have in line and the anxiety level about the war on terrorism. And in the checkout lines during the holiday season last year, I noticed a new mood and perhaps even a new appreciation for the importance of thoughtfulness and courtesy. We don't get too many chances to step back and take stock, which is why I enjoy waiting in line. What better chance do we have to slow down even while living in the fast lane than waiting in line? The haste we feel is why we bridle so much at being stuck in line, but the haste we feel is also why we should welcome the chance to wait in line. It's an opportunity to gather our thoughts, to take a break from the fast pace, and to learn something valuable about the people with whom we are waiting in line. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, and his new book, Generation Ageless, will be in bookstores October 2nd. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. This week, the organization releases its new report, Remixing Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.